Welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. This is bonus episode 20, The Pirate Patroons of the Hudson Valley. It's June 7th and the year is 1692. The time is approaching noon at Port Royal, Jamaica. Suddenly, a massive earthquake turns the spit of sand into liquid muck, and an enormous tsunami sweeps away anything that hasn't sunk below the surface waves already. This natural disaster destroys the major pirate haven of the West Indies, but will soon become a boon for another den of sin, located off the east coast of Africa. The island of St. Marie was situated northeast of Madagascar and perfectly placed along the spice routes of the British East India Company. Its syncretic ruling class of Malagasy nobles and European buccaneers had developed long tendrils reaching as far as the Hudson Valley. The first to discover the potential of this out-of-the-way enclave was a former indentured servant by the name of Thomas II. He made his life as a privateer after serving out his penal sentence on Barbados or St. Kitts. His success brought him the funds and crews necessary to attack French factories near the River Gambia. He set out in 1692 and possessed letters of marque that sanctified the venture from the governor of Bermuda. Extremely bad weather broke up this fleet, and a vote was taken to cross the thin line between piracy and privateering. The voyage of his crew would come to represent what is described as the pirate round. Ships would start in the Atlantic, move to the tip of Africa, and either up the coast or onto India. The island of St. Marie was the perfect operating base from which to intercept trade between India and North America, while also positioning oneself to seize the Islamic trade in slaves and Hajj pilgrims at the mouth of the Red Sea. 2 years before the disaster at Port Royal, a man by the name of Adam Baldridge was part of the crew of the slave ship Fortune, whose trips produced a cheaper trade in bondage over the Middle Passage. Seeing the advantage of a beautiful landlocked bay, he elected to stay on the island of St. Marie and set up shop. The bay he chose contained a protective sandbar at its mouth and was landlocked on three sides by elevated hills. These would aid in fortifications to protect the port. He quickly realized the value of his neutral stopover and ingrained himself amongst the local Malagasy nobility. He married several women of local notables and helped them pursue their wars on the mainland. This benefited Baldridge, as the wars delivered large amounts of captured slaves. As I've discussed in previous threads and on my podcast, the Dutch merchant class was uniquely positioned to leverage their international contacts within the Navigation Act system. Poorly defined slave importation contracts for stock-sharing government-backed companies also placed Madagascar in a gray area. Early English governors of New York used privateers to take enemy prizes and, of course, do some trading while they happened to be sailing, but it was the New York Dutch merchants that provided the goods and funds for these privateers. The profits were great. A slave could be purchased for a few shillings in St. Marie, as opposed to a few pounds in West Africa. The patroon was offered 200 slaves at 30 shillings per head, which equates to roughly 1.5 pounds per enslaved person. Philip stated that he could sell each individual for 30 pounds or more, resulting in a very lucrative profit. Records indicate his round-trip voyages were collecting 10,000 pieces of eight each time the patroon ship ventured forth. This haul would equal to about 2,500 pounds, and the net profit is still astronomical, even after all other expenses are paid out. There was plenty to split between the privateers, the New York politicians, and the patroons. Greed tends to break up many a good criminal enterprise, and this one was no different. Though the governors of New York issued the letters of marque and invested in the venture, eventually turning New York City into a pirate haunt all its own. Jane Zimmerman, in her book The Women of the House, paints an incredible picture of Manhattan as a true pirate haven at the end of the 17th century. In the early 1690s, New York's Governor Fletcher not only turned a blind eye to the pirates' presence in Manhattan, but actively encouraged their settlement on the island by selling amnesties for criminal acts for next to nothing. Practically every little cove on the East River sheltered a ship bearing the Jolly Roger. Pirates openly frequented the taverns of Dock Street, spending their pay on rich meals. Bulk spices and bolts of exotic fabrics from the East materialized in certain merchants' warehouses after pirate ships came into berth in the East River harbor, and few questions were asked about their provenance. After dark, pirate gangs roamed the maze of wharves and docks to appropriate the rope, sails, brass, iron fittings, and even anchors from ships and storehouses. Yet Manhattan welcomed the sailors, who spent lavishly at any establishment they patronized and pumped into the local economy nearly the equivalent of what they took out. men like Frederick Phillips decided to cut out the middleman. Privateers would pull into New York Harbor by night, but unload a significant amount of cargo onto schooners. This was sent up to the patroon's manor via the Hudson and small creeks. Eventually, this scheme would be uncovered, and the patroon would find himself thrown off the executive council in 1698 for illegally conducting the slave trade in New York. Possibly more than 700 Malagasy slaves were smuggled into the plantations of the Hudson Valley. But the pirate haven declined by the first half of the 18th century, after suffering from British government interdiction and finally Mughal attacks. And one of the most intriguing mysteries is the role of Baldridge and his pardon. He seems to have cut a deal with British authorities and was never accused of piracy, though his actions clearly violated the Navigation Acts and impeded on several national stock charter companies. It is his correspondence that finally brings down Phillips, and it seems like the British government's way of getting back at an ungrateful partner who they viewed had dishonorably cut out some very important men in New York. In another episode of illegal smuggling involving the newly christened English New York leadership and the Dutch merchants, we can glimpse the efforts to disguise and alter transnational shipments to avoid the Navigation Acts. In 1669, a ship called the Hopewell had left from Amsterdam on the way to the tobacco fields of Virginia when it made a mystery port of call in New York. Pleading a need for relief, the captain disgorged his passengers, whom happily took with them trade goods to sell. Many of the passengers were former Dutch residents of New Netherland or current residents of the English-controlled city of New York. The ship was discovered to have two manifests of dueling nationalities and was impounded for violating the Navigation Acts. This particular vessel was owned by New York's new governor, a man by the name of Francis Lovelace. He shared ownership with a conglomerate of New York and Amsterdam merchants, so he denied all involvement and managed to get the ship out of impound. Now the Amsterdam merchants hid behind a set of shell investors who all legally resided in English New York, and the Hopewell was sailing again by the end of the year. Besides hiding outside investment, the ship made sure to stop in England on its way back to Amsterdam, but was allowed to trade with New York legally in the process. Trade between New York City and the Dutch Republic amounted to between 3 to 5 large vessels per year, a similar number to direct trade with England. From the fall of New Netherlands in 1664 through the end of the century, no less than 50 prominent Dutch-descended New York traders followed this quasi-legal pattern and gained local power many other recently conquered colonial subjects would not achieve. The involvement of Lovelace in the Hopewell also highlights what would become an enduring feature of New York's political economy: the ability of colonists to bring their governors into their trade so as to insulate themselves from prosecution, to earn special privileges, and to shape local law to suit their needs, according to historian Christian Coote. Thanks for listening to New York, Quebec, and the Water Route to the Center of the World. Don't forget to check out my new YouTube channel under the title NYQC 1754 Podcast.